Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
Well, good afternoon and welcome back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. I've been looking forward to the conversation I'm just about to engage in with Dr. Lutzer. Every day it seems that here in America, our society is falling farther away from Christian values and common decency, and many of us are unsure how to respond, but respond we must. Well, in his latest book, We Will Not Be Silenced, Responding Courageously to Our Culture's Assault on Christianity, my guest, Dr. Erwin Lutzer, he equips readers with the truth of Scripture to help live out our convictions against the growing tide of hostility. Dr. David Jeremiah, he points out in the foreword that the book examines every cultural issue that we're facing. Nothing is left out. It addresses diversity issues, racial issues, gender issues, social justice, and much more. Once again, We Will Not Be Silenced arms believers with a deeper understanding of the hurts and concerns of non-believers with regard to social issues, so the church is able to respond in a compassionate and gentle manner. Well, Dr. Lutzer is the pastor emeritus of the Moody Church, where he served as the senior pastor for 36 years, a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and Loyola University. He's the author of numerous books, including the Gold Medallion Award winner, Hitler's Cross, and the bestseller, 1 Minute After You Die. He's also a teacher on radio programs, heard on more than 700 stations. We are delighted to have him with us today to talk about this very timely book, We Will Not Be Silenced. Dr. Lutzer, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm so glad that I can join you and so glad for your ministry.
Well, I appreciate your encouragement. This is such a timely book. I suppose one would wonder, is this a prophetic screed or is this just, having the insight to see where our country has been going for a very long period of time and how we as the church ought to respond and the need for us to be aware? What inspired you to release this book at this time and to write it in general for the sake of the church and the culture?
Well, you know, the way it has worked out, first of all, let me say I wrote the book when I began to realize that the radical left does not believe that America can be fixed. It must be destroyed. And then on the foundations, on the rubble of our Christian Judeo heritage, they want to build a new America based on Marxist principles. And, you know, one of the things that I discovered, in fact, the first chapter is on Marxism, I didn't realize that cultural Marxism, which means that Marxism is to be implemented incrementally, really underlies everything that is happening in our society that isn't good. And that's why I get into diversity issues, you know, a biblical view of race as opposed to social justice. And there's a right way to talk about social justice, but there's also a wrong way. And then critical race theory, why it is. In fact, I might say that one of the reasons I wrote it, among many others, is so that when parents send their kids off to school and they come back hating America, parents would understand what is being taught to my child about America. And why do they come back saying that we are such a racist nation and all of those other things? But I have 8 different assaults that are directed against the church, but each chapter ends with an admonition as to what I think the church should be doing.
And I appreciate that so much, because one can leave hopeless when you consider where we stand as a nation today. I think for many people, the wake-up call really began with this latest presidential election, but it's healthy for us to have a clear understanding of what direction the culture is taking. I think it's important to point out a statement that you make in the book to give our listeners some perspective on where you come from. You write that, "I am opposed to a form of Christianity that judges without licensing and sees the faults of others without seeing our own. As a pastor, my heart breaks for those who hurt, who are confused, and who don't know where to turn for help. Our churches should be sanctuaries for the downtrodden, the oppressed, and the lonely. They should be hospitals for the soul." You take a very compassionate approach, but I am grateful to say that it's also a thoroughly biblical approach to the issues confronting us today as the church and a nation.
As a matter of fact, when it comes to issues of sexuality, for example, I point out it is much better to be thought of as hateful and speak the truth than to speak lies with compassionate tones and a sense of caring. So yes, what I do is emphasize the need for truth. There's always that balance, love and truth. But I really do think that unless we approach the culture with brokenness, unless that happens, you know, we aren't going to be heard. And so what we need to do is to try to understand where people are coming from and to listen to them. By the way, it just comes to mind that one of my chapters, for example, is on propaganda. And I point out that the purpose of propaganda is to so change people's perception of reality that no matter how much counter evidence, they will not change their minds. And so how are we going to change people's minds? Well, we do need to listen and so forth. But we are actually, and I know that there's a lot of information swirling around right now because of the presidential election. But, you know, my heart breaks because I think we are on the verge of seeing things against the church that we've never seen before. And, you know, we could talk about any one of these things, but even the sexualization of children, for example, or socialism, which happens to be, I think, one of the longest chapters in my book. So at what is happening, and by the way, thank you so much for your intro. You ask whether or not it's a prophetic book. Actually, this book was written and completed in about August almost of this year. Well, I guess maybe a little bit earlier than that. Let's just say July and August. And so it deals with the tearing down of monuments, what's going on there, the whole issue of race in America, the way in which it's being approached, what children and young people are learning today in their schools. So all those issues are ones that I've talked about.
Yes, yes. Well, I want to cover much of that as much as our time will permit. But let's begin with a subject that you mentioned early on, and that is cultural Marxism. The word is being used quite often these days. But let's talk about what it is and what its goals are so that we as the body of Christ, those of us who are committed to biblical truth, what we need to know in order to effectively minister to our communities and confront falsehood.
Thank you so much for asking that. That's one of the most important questions. When Marx gave his theories, we know that in Russia and other countries, Marxism came with a revolution with guns and the killing of millions of people and so forth. Marx is basically statism, that the state has to take over the means of production. The state has to take the place of God. All right, he believed that the key to history was oppression. And if we could just rid the world of oppression, everybody would live together in harmony and peace. And here's a very important point. He believed that the family, the nuclear family, was a great hindrance to the glories and the beauty of the Marxist state. Why? Families were a unit of oppression. You know, husbands oppressed their wives, parents oppressed their children, they took them to church. God was the ultimate oppressor. And so what he needed to do is to break up the nuclear family. And furthermore, families tend to pass on their wealth. Well, that's contrary to the Marxist view of inequality. So what he did is he said that women have to work outside the home, the children have to be raised by the state, and so forth. Okay, that's Marxism. Cultural Marxism says we can bring these same changes about, but do it incrementally so that people will want Marxism because they will see how valuable it is and they will see its benefits. So what we can do by capturing law, by capturing education, by capturing the media and even elections, we can bring about the beauties of Marxism as it is believed. We can do that without killing people. We can do it even, quote, demographically, of course, I mean, from the standpoint of democracy. We can do it that way. And so his whole, so cultural Marxism comes along and says, let's do it bit by bit. Now, people need to understand, as I've emphasized, that the goals are the same. The state has to be supreme, and dependence upon the state is absolutely important. And so that's why oftentimes you find this lurch toward socialism. Mm-hmm. Oh, I could talk about that for a moment. Let me just
we're going to take a break and we'll give you an opportunity to talk about that. Finish your thought, but we'll return and talk a bit about socialism.
Yeah, socialism always talks about how to divide wealth. It never talks about creating it because it can't create it. That's simply in a couple of sentences.
Hey, you're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We're talking this afternoon with Dr. Erwin Lutzer. His latest book, We Will Not Be Silenced, Responding Courageously to Our Culture's Assault on Christianity. We need to take a quick break, but we will be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show, and I'm continuing my conversation with Dr. Erwin Lutzer. He is the author of We Will Not Be Silenced, Responding Courageously to Our Culture's Assault on Christianity, covering all of the major issues of our day and giving us an understanding, but also a Christian perspective on how we can respond to the culture. Now, just before the break, we were talking about your longest chapter, which is on socialism and why it's so attractive and why it must fail and how we as believers should respond, because along with the discussion of socialism, we're hearing and have for quite some time statements that Jesus was a socialist, and this is more reflective of Christianity than is capitalism, for example.
Yeah, very good questions. Here's the important thing. As I mentioned before the break, socialism only talks about how to divide wealth and not how to create it. And the reason is because socialism cannot create wealth. When you have equality of income, for example, Rebecca and I have been in Russia where in the 1980s, where a doctor was paid essentially as much as other hospital workers. Well, obviously, there was a great dearth of doctors who would want to be a doctor. So socialism has to control wages. It has to control earnings. It cannot create wealth. And so when it runs out of money, you remember Margaret Thatcher's very famous line when she says the problem with socialism is that pretty soon you run out of other people's money. Well, when you run out of other people's money, there's only one thing that the government can do, and that is to create more money. And so you have rampant inflation as all of these things begin to happen. Only the freedom of capitalism is able to create wealth. I want to throw this in, and then I'll answer your question about Jesus. But it has been said, why is it that mice die in mouse traps? Well, the answer is because they don't understand why the cheese is free. Now, that being said, was Jesus a socialist? Absolutely not. I point out that in the New Testament, for example, there was no socialism. But let's talk about Jesus. Jesus told a parable in which he said that there was one man who was given 10 talents, and another man was given 5, and another 3, and another 1. Jesus knew that there would not be equality of income. We should seek equality of opportunity for people, but there will never be equality of outcomes. There's always going to be a difference as to how much people earn and their station in life. What the Bible does require, however, is that everybody is responsible for what they have. Luke 12:48, unto whom much is given, much is required. Those who haven't received much will be judged by a different standard. God is not a socialist. He didn't treat Hammurabi the way he treated Abraham. He sovereignly saves Abraham and chooses the Jews. And so the whole idea that you're going to have socialism, which is imposed by the state and forced upon us, is really totally foreign to the scriptures.
You also have a chapter, and I love that you included this because it's so important today. One of the most interesting chapters is on propaganda. Now, what are the goals and how are these goals being achieved? And what's the means by which propaganda is being being used?
Propaganda is used in many different ways. Sometimes slogans, for example, contain a lot of propaganda. I refer to Hitler because the same-sex movement, the homosexual movement in the early 80s, wrote a book on how they were going to change America's perception of homosexuality. And they actually said that they were relying on some things that Hitler had said. Because Hitler said that with the right use of propaganda, you can make heaven appear like hell and hell appear like heaven. So there are different ways it's done, but let's dive into this business of slogans. When Hitler starved children, he called it putting them on a low-calorie diet. And you think, for example, in our abortion clinics today, nobody talks about the killing of preborn infants. What do they talk about? They talk about the termination of a pregnancy and a woman's right to choose. So what you do is you hide what you are doing. When Hitler wanted to exterminate the Jews, he called it the cleansing of the land. And today, of course, you oftentimes have slogans. Let's even talk about Black Lives Matter. Do Black Lives Matter? Of course they matter. All Black Lives Matter, including the ones that are shot oftentimes here in the city of Chicago every week. And I don't mean to imply that only Black lives are shot. I'm just simply saying that, of course, Black Lives Matter. But the organization that takes that mantra actually is Marxist. That's why it seeks the destruction of the family that we talked about earlier in the show. And one of the founders says, we are trained Marxists.
Marxist, yes.
What is my point? You use slogans that appear to be good, but you use it to camouflage what it is that you're really going to do. So that's one way propaganda is. The other is you enforce it by fear and hate, and you make people fear that if they don't fall in line, they are going to be in trouble. And we have lots of examples of that happening in our society today. There's a doctor who said that when he gives transgender people or people who think that they are transgender, he cannot tell them about the harm that will come to them if they have transgender surgery, because he would be fired as a doctor. So he cannot even practice his trade with what he knows. So we are living at a time when propaganda is put forth with fear and hatred. And so you have what I call cultural streams that oftentimes are very difficult to withstand.
You also have an interesting chapter on how the radical left is teaming up with Islam to destroy America. Now, that may seem nonsensical to some of your readers and our listeners. Why that would be the case, I guess the ends justify the means. But can you talk a bit about that very interesting chapter that might surprise your readers?
Well, yeah. And the reason that they are together is not because they agree. Islam, of course, a very supremacist religion wanting to impose Islam, Sharia law. Why would the radical left join with them? Well, in military terms, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So what happens is you will always find the left defending Islam. There is separation of church and state. We've heard about that for a long time. But when money is used, and it is being used, to build prayer rooms for Muslim students in our public schools, there's no opposition from the ACLU. More ominously, there are schools today in America where Islam is being taught, and when parents object, the parents are called haters and intolerant and everything else. Could you imagine schools where Christianity were taught? And so in that chapter, I also talk about Islam's view of immigration. In the Quran, it is very important to understand that immigration is seen as a means of spreading the faith. Now, there are many Muslims in America who have picked up on Western values. They have no special intention of imposing Islam, but the radicals certainly do. And while I'm on the topic, there are churches today that have, a common idea of bringing in an imam for Christian dialogue with Muslims. This is so wrong. I quote a book written by Muslims for Muslims on how to make Islam palatable to Americans so that they are willing to accept it. I'm not opposed to a debate, but where somebody is allowed to give his own view without contradiction and without any rebuttal, oftentimes this leads to a very skewed view of what Islam is really like.
We're talking with Dr. Erwin Lutzer, and I think we have time for one more segment. His book is titled, We Will Not Be Silenced, Responding Courageously to Our Culture's Assault on Christianity, an important book for us to understand the culture, and more importantly, our response as believers, as followers of Christ. One of the things that he states is that what a special privilege it is to be called to represent Christ at this pivotal moment in history. We are called for such a time as this, and we must pray that our light might shine more brightly than ever in our darkening world. Now, many of us feel like, Lord God, why did you place me here and why am I living now? We're more frustrated by it all. And yet, I think the position that he has taken is the right one because God has placed us in this strategic point in history for his good purpose. We'll continue our conversation in just a few moments. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show, and I'm continuing my conversation with Dr. Erwin Lutzer. He is the author of We Will Not Be Silenced, Responding Courageously to Our Culture's Assault on Christianity. You have a chapter titled Vilify, 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 and how disagreements are being resolved or failing to be resolved is perhaps a better way of putting it. Can you give us an example of what this means for the church today, our unwillingness to simply be civil to one another, to accept that we have disagreements, rather than to vilify one's opponent so that there can not only be agreement, but we can't even associate because our opponents are always evil?
Exactly. That's the way in which the left looks at things. It's not just that you disagree with me and we have a disagreement, but you disagree with me, therefore you are evil. So you asked, Georgine, the question of give an example. Well, I could give many, but here in Missouri, there is a church which last year, just a year ago now, the pastor preached a message on Genesis 1:27, saying that there are only two genders. Now, he was so kind. He talked about those who struggle with same-sex attraction or those who believe they're transgender. In fact, the message was so kind and so loving, I wondered whether or not he was going to land the plane, so to speak, but he did. The next day, that church was vilified in the newspapers. It was on television throughout Missouri, and students at the university said, I don't know if I can feel safe this was the city of Columbia. I don't know that I can feel safe in Columbia if there's a church that believes there are only two genders. You know, I deal with this in the book, how there's safism today where, you said something that offended me. I need a safe place because my oppression is not being fully realized. Well, anyway, this church had raised 2 months before $420,000 to pay for all the outstanding hospital bills for people in their community. They had been actively involved in the community in so many helpful ways and in terms of the poor and all. You know, it is often said we need to be known for what we are for and not just for what we are against. This church was widely known for what it was for. But when it came time for them to be against something, everybody forgot that, and this church was vilified. Well, that's coming to a church near you. But that yes. gives an example of how we are living at a time today when we find civil discourse very difficult, because everybody is enraged by something. Everybody is offended by something. And so people are totally paralyzed. They don't know what they can say. You know, you just say the wrong thing and people will hop on you, and on social media, pretty soon you will be doxxed. You'll be taken care of and you'll be canceled. Look at Drew Brees. You know, he said that he stood for the flag because he wanted to honor it. Well, the mob got after him. He apologized not once, but twice. Why? Because today we hear this. Oh, yes, you have the First Amendment. You can express your views, but if you express a wrong view, we will cancel you. Now, in that chapter, I tell one other story that I need to tell very quickly. What you need when you have a revolution always is a pretext. Kristallnacht, 1937 in Germany. Jewish businesses were burned, synagogues were burned, etc. We all know about it historically. That didn't happen in a vacuum. What happened was there was a German diplomat who was shot by a Jewish student in Paris. Hitler told his fire departments and his police to stand back. He said Jewish businesses and synagogues were going to be burned. The man who was shot was Ernst Rott. Now, I can just imagine, and I'm using my imagination here, that there were people marching the streets of Germany. We just want justice for Ernst. Justice for Ernst. Well, we saw that during the riots when we just want justice for George Floyd. We just want justice. So what you need is a pretext that will give legitimacy to your revolution. That also ties in with some of the things that we talked about, propaganda. But today, everybody's enraged, and freedom of speech is greatly jeopardized because everybody fears what they might say that might be wrong.
Absolutely. By the way, today happens to be the anniversary. 1938 was Kristallnacht. Today was the day that occurred in Germany. We're talking about the book, We Will Not Be Silenced. It's just an excellent book to help us understand the culture, how to respond courageously to our culture's assault on Christianity, and to do so in a way that upholds the standards that Christ has set for us. Now, the final chapter of your book is based on the words of Jesus to the church in Sardis. Strengthen what remains is the phrase. And what do you think Jesus might say and is saying to the church today, because he still speaks to us through his word?
Well, what was wrong with the church in Sardis? They had a reputation of being alive, but they were dead. And the problem with the church in Sardis was that they no longer saw the world as an enemy. So they embraced their culture. And I suggest that what Jesus would say to the church today is, number one, be sure that you are clear on the gospel, be gospel driven, and don't get caught up in social justice. Now, there's a right way to define it and a wrong way. That would be a separate discussion. But there are many churches today that no longer evangelize because they are into social justice. Number two, Jesus would talk about the sexuality of the culture. As a matter of fact, what happened in Sardis was the church bought into pagan culture and sexuality. So I point that out. And then I think the third thing that he would say is, love me more than you love your sin. And there I talk briefly about social media technology, which is a tremendous enemy of the church today. Now, it's good. We all use technology. We all use our computers, and we use Zoom and everything else. But the point is that so much which is on the internet is impure. It is instantly addictive. And so I weep for the younger generation caught up in technology. So Jesus would say that, and then he would tell us to be sure to remain strong and to know that how we look in heaven is much more important than how we look on earth.
Amen. Where can our listeners acquire a copy of We Will Not Be Silenced? Because every one of them needs a copy of this book.
Thank you so much for asking. Of course, they can buy it on Amazon, but there are many listeners who might want to support our Moody Media Ministry. So here's what they can do. They can go to MCM. That, of course, stands for Moody Church Media, but it's all one word, MCM Offer, OFFER.com. And for a gift of any amount, it will be sent out immediately. That's MCMOffer.com. And I want to thank many listeners in advance for helping us. Running to Win is now in more than 20 different countries, all because of our wonderful supporters.
Well, Dr. Lutzer, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. But most importantly, for this book, We Will Not Be Silenced. It's an important book that covers the issues that the church is facing today and gives us some clear direction on how we might effectively minister in this very time that God has placed us in.
Thank you so much, Georgine.
Thank you. And once again, I so appreciate what he says. What a special privilege it is to be called to represent Christ at this pivotal moment in history. It may not feel like that. You may wish you were from an easier time, and yet God has appointed us to this time. We need to be equipped so that we can, as the subtitle of the book says, respond courageously to our culture's assault on Christianity, because more than anything else, the culture needs Jesus. And if we don't tell them, how will they know?
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.